Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 247 of What Most People Think. And oh my God, have you got a local election fever? Has it gripped you yet? Crime commissioner fever, mayoral elections, Humza Yousaf resigning, it seems. It's all going on. And thank God, I would say, that we have Ian Dale joining us to co-host again. Ian.
Nobody's ever said, thank God we have Ian Dale.
Well, listen, with all this political stuff going on, mate, I mean, first up, are you ready for the local elections? Have you got all the stimulants in to make sure you can stay up and whatever form that takes?
That's going to be quite an interesting experience because I'm co-hosting the LBC election night show with Sheila Fogarty and Andrew Marr and Ben Kentish, and we're going to be up from 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. I've then got to get on one of those Virgin motorbikes to go to Good Morning Britain to be on air at 6:20.
Oh my God.
And then I'm moving from 4 to 5 days a week doing my evening show. So the first Friday is next Friday, so I'm going to be absolutely knackered by the end of that.
Oh, God, I was just joking about the stimulants, but I'll put you in touch with a guy, mate.
No, I absolutely need them, yeah.
I mean, the weird thing is, in this week of all weeks, the local election results may not be the biggest story, because obviously we're going to deal with the Humza Yousaf thing coming up. But there's also the mayoral elections, which I think are really interesting. They've got a kind of status as well. And some of those might not go as people expect, but we'll obviously be getting into that as the show goes on. My tour finished as we're talking. We're recording this, just a timestamp on this, Monday, 11 a.m. So obviously if Humza Yousaf comes out and does a Wolf of Wall Street types, I'm not stepping down. Suddenly decides that while he's up there, I want to carry on. We're going to keep fighting. I don't think that's going to happen. That'll be why. But I did the last show of the tour last night, Ian, in Wimbledon Theatre. And my God.
That's quite a big one, isn't it?
Yeah. It must be nice when you fill it. but it's just like, look, for me, I think it was the most tickets I sold on the tour, but like it holds 1,600. And it was a Sunday night in Wimbledon, but we were well attended and they made a great noise. And I was saying to my wife, like, when I actually started developing this show was kind of the summer of 2022. I think I wrote my first joke for Basic Bloke when Boris Johnson was still in charge. And there was peace in the Middle East, more or less. I mean, it's definitely changed over time. I know that obviously you do life on the road as well. You've been taking your podcast and chat on the road. I saw you in Dublin not so long ago.
Yeah, that was amazing. I think you'd been there the week before, hadn't you? But not in the same venue. I mean, I thought, is there really enough of our podcast listeners in Dublin to make this work? But we sold, I think, 220, 240 tickets, something like that, which I thought was phenomenal. And it was a great night. You just know, do you have this thing where you walk into a venue and you instantly know whether it's going to work or not?
So was you at the Laughter Lounge?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do club gigs there. I mean, first up to say 240, you know, when you said, oh, do we have enough listeners in Dublin to make this work? And then you got your answer, yes. When I did Dublin, I got my answer and it was the opposite in many ways. But I would say that the people that did turn up to my show in Dublin were absolute peaches, like really lovely people. But yeah, the Laughter Lounge, it's got a good feel about it and stuff. And
you walk into it, first of all, it's a bit like a school hall, isn't it? But you just, yes. It's got this vibe somehow that makes you think it'll work. And it really did. And it's like set out with tables, so it's a bit sort of cabaret style, and yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm already excited about writing stuff for the next tour. I mean, one of the things I like about doing this job, and I'm sure that you had this experience taking your show on the road, is that you just get to see loads of different places. I sort of, you know, I was in Ilkley on Friday night, and it's a really nice place. And I always sound patronizing to northerners when I say this, like, you know what, Ian, There are places up north that have nice properties.
It's really not so bad.
They have nice restaurants. I mean, really, some of them have got broadband. You know, Ilkley is just one of those surprise places that I suspect I would never have gone in my life were it not for comedy. And so it is genuinely a privilege to go all these places and just meet nice people.
Well, we've got one in Broadstairs coming up in Kent. I live in Kent, but it's right up the other end. Some people would say the arse end, but obviously I wouldn't.
Yes.
And it's for what they're dubbing the Ted Fest. You may remember Ted Heath was born and brought up in Broadstairs.
Mm.
And Arundel's, his home in Salisbury, is quite expensive to keep up. So they're doing a fundraising festival. So Jackie Smith and I are doing our For the Many podcast at this thing. And I think it's on the 13th of July. Then I'm doing a literary event on one of my books.
Oh, darling.
And then in the evening, Michael McManus, who used to work for Ted Heath, he's putting on his play Maggie and Ted. So it's going to be a cultural feast in Broadstairs on the 13th of July.
Ted Fest, Ted Talk.
No.
We love a bit of Ted. Cheerful guy. Okay, we're going to do the new patrons here. We got three this week. Remember, if you are a patron, you get the podcast early, ad-free, with bonus content. We also get, literally last week, we did the patron-only episode whereby VIP-level patrons, your questions get guaranteed answers and everyone else gets to throw some in the mix as well. So we've got Henry Moxon, who just sounds like, he sounds like a sort of eccentric cricket commentator. Is Henry Moxon here? Can we go commentating on the county cricket? Here I am. Yeah, Henry Moxon, one of those guys with the egg and bacon coloured blazers. You know, those really jazzy looking things. We got Katie Fjord. I don't know if her name's Katie Ford and she just pressed F twice or whether she is legitimately Norwegian. And we've got Nick Guy. Nick Guy just sounds like, hey, Nick Guy. Well, yeah, I bet he speaks with one of those voices.
Hairdresser.
Oh, yeah, one of those hairdressers from the 80s. Do you remember?
No.
Do you remember, like, Vidal Sassoon? What happened to those guys? Paul Mitchell? I always thought that, like, chefing and hairstyling was one of those things where, obviously, the majority of that in day-to-day life is done by women. No offence, just talking statistical realities. But then somehow, at the top of those games, you got blokes going, hey! And the guys that were famous for cutting hair always had shit hair as well.
Or no hair. That's always weird, isn't it? When you get a bald hairdresser, particularly if it's a woman.
Particularly if it's a woman. But look, I'm not going to be like Angela Rayner. I'm not going to bald shame. I have, you know, after Angela Rayner's comment calling Rishi Sunak a pint-sized loser, it has made me reflect on some hype-based comments that I've made. I mean, just one minor comment there. A lot of people said, oh, it was a joke. I don't think it was a joke. It was an insult, wasn't it? A joke is something like when Boris called Keir Starmer a human bollard. There was some sort of creativity with language that qualifies it as a joke. But pint-sized and loser, it's not a joke, is it?
Well, it's hardly an insult, though. I mean, if you're going to insult Rishi Sunak, couldn't you come up with something more hard-hitting than that? And yet people have gone off their trolleys on it, saying, oh, she shouldn't be saying these sort of things. I mean, please, it's not. I doubt whether he would have been offended by it. I don't think anybody would have been offended by it. I mean, it's hardly as if she called him scum, is it?
Yeah, no, she'd never do that. God bless Angela. No. David Domain, our super patron who listens to the last episode and gives us feedback and talking points. He really enjoyed having Rachel Fairburn on. A lot of great feedback from the patrons about Rachel. He says, one of the joys of the podcast is I get to hear from people I've not been aware of. I think Rachel came across brilliantly, instantly likable, loved her personality and accent. And he just confirms that Angela Rayner is indeed from, and he mocks the way that I say, evidently the way I say Greater Manchester. He's not proper English, so he spelled it phonetically. So I take the point, David. She's from Stockport, and her constituency is in Ashton-under-Lyme there. So, yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I just saw with Angela Rayner at PMQs, it was a great piece of counterintuitive logic, wasn't she? It was like, oh, are they going to mention her housing situation? Yeah. And she just immediately stood up and went, so, my housing situation. You just see Oliver Dowden piss his pants.
Yeah, sort of Humza Yousaf has done that, hasn't he, a bit? And when he said, well, to the Greens, well, you're talking about coming out of the Beat House Agreement. I'm going to beat you to it, which I thought was a masterstroke, first of all. But within about 6 hours, it all collapsed around him. But we may come into that.
What most people think.
We're just going to do a quick thank you and a fuck you. I'll handle the thank you. Thank you to everybody that came to the charity show Standing Up for Blokes and Boys last Monday. I mean, it was interesting, Ian. You know, I have got used to the idea that in certain media quarters, when I talk about men's wellness, men's mental health, that it does get ridiculed, you know, in some places by female journalists sometimes. And I found myself on another show where I was talking about it. And then very quickly, within like 20 seconds, we were talking about the fact that there weren't enough radio opportunities for women. I thought, how the fuck has this happened? It's happening again. You know, this time, I don't think it would have led to the potential cancellation of GB News. But there's so much goodwill as well out there for the cause. Loads of people contributed to the fundraiser. The lineup was just ridiculous. Do you know what the lineup was, Ian? It was Tom Davis, there was Josh Widdicombe, Sean Walsh, Marcus Brigsoff, Simon Evans. He obliterated it after the interval. It was incredible. But the thing that I had to contend with, I don't know if you have this when I do the live shows, but I came out and my wife was in the front row. I mean, obviously my wife is not in your front row. She might be. I don't know what's going on. But you know, when you have either a partner or a family member, she was right there. And listen, once it's going well, it's fine. But the jeopardy there is fucking massive. Like, the idea of dying on your ass is bad enough, but then with a person just sitting there, just looking and thinking, Jesus Christ, so how long's left on our mortgage?
When did you last die on your ass?
Do you know what I was thinking about this tour? This tour was 78 dates, and God, well, I can say it now, not one of them I would say was a bad gig. And like, there are ones where you kind of go, it was kind of, you know, like sometimes, do you ever have sex that's going very well in the middle, but ends in a, like, oh.
Well, let me break this to you, Jeff. When you get to 61, you just don't.
You just, you don't have sex, or it just doesn't end?
Well, apart from with yourself.
You know what? I think it's liberating, Ian. I think it creates more time for hobbies, let's be honest. Well, this now seems connected in some small way. The fuck you. What's your fuck you, Ian Dale?
I've got two, but I'll try and be brief. One is Taylor Swift.
It's in there.
Because I thought I would download her new album to try and find out what all the fuss was about. I think I have got another one of her albums on my phone, but I've never really listened to it. And I went through this 31-song album of dirge. And it's quite pleasant.
31?
31 songs. Apparently, the 15 downloaded, and then to surprise her loyal fans, they got another 16 12 hours later.
Whoever came up with bonus 16 tracks? You go, bonus track. Bizarre. Couple of B-sides.
I mean, they're all sort of quite pleasant, but there isn't a memorable song among them. There's nothing that you think, oh, in 20 years' time, that will be played on gold. There's absolutely nothing there. So I'm a bit mystified about her appeal. I mean, I know I'm not the target audience, but even so, I know a good tune when I hear one, and she needs to get better writers. And it's all about her sort of ex-boyfriends. And you think, well, love, you're not going to get another boyfriend if they think the first thing you're going to do when you break up with them is write a song about them and the fact that they type on the typewriter.
Oh, you might get the kind of boyfriend that wants to be written about on a song, and that's not necessarily a good thing either.
That is very true. And my other fuck you is people who don't understand why voter ID is a good thing.
Oh, okay.
Given that virtually every other country in the world uses it, Northern Ireland uses it, doesn't suppress voter turnout there, apparently. And why shouldn't you have to identify yourself? Because people say, oh, there have been so few convictions of people. Well, of course there have, because how do you actually identify someone who's voted multiple times unless you've got CCTV in each polling station? So, yeah, there have only been two or three convictions. Hmm. But I remember from my time in politics, on polling day, we would get calls every hour from people saying, well, I've gone to vote, and they tell me that somebody's voted in my name.
Oh, really?
And I think it's a much bigger problem than people realise. And I don't see why you shouldn't have to identify yourself in some way.
I did see a poster. There's been a campaign, which I presume was financed by a left-wing organisation, said, don't let them stop you voting. And I thought the language of it was so sort of confrontational and combative. And like you say, it's one of these things that gets represented. Look, I do think it's an example of something that if it had come in under a Labour government, there would have been some pushback probably from the harder left. But the presumption is that it's this mendacious, hard right, fascistic policy, when the recommendation actually came from the Electoral Commission, right?
Did it?
I think so.
Well, if it did, then they're being, as usual, hypocrites because they've criticised the way it's been done. I mean, I think there are one or two things to criticise about it. Like, for example, they've said there's all sorts of different forms of ID that you can use. And if you're an old person, you can use your bus pass as ID. But if you're a young person, you can't. So the natural suspicion there is they're doing that because they don't want young people to vote because obviously they vote mainly.
Now, I have some sympathy with. If they're going, if you watch Bargain Hunt, you can vote, but if most of your TV is YouTube streamers, then I'm afraid that doesn't count. Read into that what you will. Okay, right, let's crack into the politics here. We're going to start off by talking about Hamza Yousef. Okay, so Ian, Humza Yousaf, by the time this goes out, I believe that he will have resigned. It seems absolutely nailed on, but I think these events are still worth talking through regardless. Talk me through the events that have led to this. Let's have a little recent potted history of Humza Yousaf.
Well, like many politicians who take over from long-term successful leaders, he hasn't had an easy time. If you think back, John Major, Gordon Brown, similar situation to that, where Nicholas
David Sturgeon, Moyes.
So he came in last March. And look, Nicola Sturgeon was inevitably going to be a hard act to follow. If we think back 16 months, so go back to January 2023 when she was still in office. Doesn't matter what your politics are, she was somebody that most of us admired, not least for the way she could communicate. She held a party together. I mean, I don't think she led a particularly successful government in many ways, but she was seen as a good leader. And so she surprised everyone by quitting, and it's all fallen to pieces since then, not just because of the SNP finances issue, but also because Humza Yousaf, who succeeded her after the contest with Kate Forbes and Ash Regan, he never really seemed to have a direction that he could lead people to go into. And it just seemed to be one crisis after another. And I think he's actually a genuinely nice guy.
He seems. I do quite warm to him, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I first started in radio in 2010 and I interviewed him when I think he was 27. I think he was the youngest MSP elected. And I remember saying to my producer, that guy will be first minister one day. He just was really impressive and came across as a complete human being, not a sort of machine politician. But I think over the years, time has eroded that. And he's become more of a sort of typical politician in some ways. He wasn't a great success, I think, in most of the ministerial jobs he had. And he sort of won by default, because after Kate Forbes did all of her Christian stuff, that damaged her. She did get 48% in the end. So I think he was always on a bit of a hiding to nothing, and particularly with the coalition with the Greens.
He inherited that, right, from Sturgeon?
Yes.
I think it's the Bute House agreement. And there was always this fear, like, in a way, and certainly on the more small-C conservative SNP types, was that they were a bit crazy, a bit Fruit Loops. You know, some of their policies on both the climate and gender, you know, were potentially problematic. And that was evidenced by, I can't remember their leader's name, but he sort of flat out refused to accept the cash report.
Patrick Harvey.
He was just like, yeah, so you're not following the science. So on the one hand, if you're saying, look, when it comes to climate, we're following the science. And go, what about the science of sexual biology and reality? No, we're not following that science.
Well, the SNP, bizarrely, went down a complete rabbit hole on those issues. And I mean, it really started, I suppose, with the case of the transgender woman who was put in a women's prison despite having male sexual organs. And most people who are not obsessed by these issues thought that is just wrong. And so that was sort of the start of the decline on this. And then their response to the CAS report and Humza Yousaf's insults to J.K. Rowling as well, I think, didn't help. It's always bemused me as to why politicians have got hung up on this issue in the way, not just in Scotland, but in England too. And in a sense, you could almost feel that it was going to end in tears. And I think it is that issue more than any that will have been behind Humza Yousaf's resignation, because he wasn't willing to compromise on it. I remember I did a leadership debate in Glasgow with the three of them, and he was straight down the line, I won't sort of brook any dissent from this position that we've already established. Well, times move on. And if you can't adapt to the latest evidence that comes forward, and I think whatever side of the trans debate you're on, the CAS report raised some very important issues.
What most people think.
He's had this foot-in-mouth capacity as well, that the sort of the hapless nature that follows politicians like him around. Liz Truss, obviously, had it kind of par excellence. I don't know if you saw the clip, the sort of famous clip when he was at a refuge centre and he was surrounded by Ukrainian women. And he looked around and genuinely said, oh, there's only women there. Where are all the men? And one of the women went, well, they're fighting in the war. You could just see his face go, oh, for fuck's sake, I've done it again.
But we've all been there, haven't we? There's that pressure to say something just to sort of fill a silence. And inevitably you come out with something that's bollocks.
And I suppose those moments are, in a way, like they don't speak for a person's entire political character, but they give you an idea of what somebody's like under pressure. And under the pressure of sort of like the Bute House agreement, I mean, as you say, the rationale of getting out ahead of, you know, they thought that the Greens might collapse the agreement. Hamza Yousif said, right, I'm going to get out ahead of this. I'm going to be the one that collapses the agreement. They sort of effectively dumped them by text. But has he wargamed this badly, or did he find himself in a position where sort of all roads led to what's happening now?
Look, we're recording this about half an hour before he speaks. So I don't know why he's going to resign, because it looks as if the Greens had decided that they would abstain on one of the no confidence motions. So I'm not sure whether there was a need. And I always think it's better in these situations to go down fighting rather than just accept defeat. And he could have had a glorious defeat and then maybe come back. But I don't think if he resigns now, there's any way back for him. And I don't think whoever replaces him, I doubt whether they would offer him a place in their cabinet.
I mean, that's the thing, in a way, with the Greens might have played this badly too, because if you look at, like, if they could have just offered him some level of support, if you look at the parties at Holyrood, who is going to be on side with the crankier ends of their bullshit? It's going to be the SNP. Whether they've had a lover's tiff or not, you know, whether they've divided up who gets the car, and, well, probably not them. When you break up with the Greens, you get to keep all of the electrical goods is one positive. There's a chance that they've played this badly too. And the real kind of benefit, I mean, the real benefit of, look, anything that happens political, ultimately, it's always Keir Starmer. That's the rule. Whatever happens politically in the news, at some point, Keir Starmer will benefit. So I'm going to be asking him for his lottery numbers. Right. So another thing that could benefit Keir Starmer, and almost certainly will, is the local elections. Now, what's interesting about these, right, is that they are set against... So a recent set of local elections were actually compared to, I think, 2019, where the Tories had done badly. So even though they did badly, it was compared to a previous set, which was also bad. These are against, I think, 2021, when the Tories did okay at local elections. So are these just going to look a hell of a lot worse?
I think, in all likelihood, they will be. But how old were you in 1990?
About 14.
Do you remember Ken Baker?
I do remember. It was a little snail guy from Spitting Image. Is that Ken Baker?
That's the one.
Oh my God, that show had power, didn't it? Fuck me.
He was chairman of the Tory party at the time. And Margaret Thatcher was probably at her most unpopular. The poll tax had just come in and the Tories took an absolute thrashing in the 1990 May local elections. However, they managed to retain Westminster and Wandsworth. And so Ken Baker came out of central office the next day, beaming to his heart's content and claiming victory because they'd held on to those two. And the media completely swallowed it and it all went away. Now, you can see this happening again in that if they manage to hold on to the West Midlands mayoralty with Andy Street and the Tees Valley one with Ben Houchen, they could try and repeat that exercise. I think we've got a much more cynical media now, so I'm not sure they would get away with it. But in terms of the local elections, I think they could lose maybe half of their seats that are coming up at this election. I can't see anything other than disaster. And people might think that it's a ridiculous thing to suggest, but I reckon there's a 20% chance that Tory MPs will do what they do best and panic after these elections and think, well, we need another leader. Now, most of the country would think this is absolutely preposterous. You can't have a fourth one. Not another one, as Brenda might say. But if they come to the conclusion that someone like Kemi Badenoch or Penny Mordaunt might lose them 20 fewer seats than Rishi Sunak would, they might press the nuclear button. Mm. And I think the chances of that happening are increasing slightly as each day passes. He's got several choices after Thursday. He could come out on Friday morning. I mean, let's assume a total wipeout, disastrous results. Mm. He could come out and say, I'm calling an election now, or I'm going to call it for, say, June, the early June. Mm. Or what I think he should do, I suspect he won't, but what he could do is come out and say, I'm calling it for November the 14th.
Yeah.
And I think that would be quite a clever move. I suppose it could backfire in some way, but I think that would, I mean, it'd be an effective dead cat. Well, yes, we may have had terrible election results, but here's the dead cat. I've called an election. And that's what I would then be talking about on my programme on Friday night, I guess.
I think you're absolutely right. It gives him 6 months. It gives him a window of time to turn things around. There was something that you said in that very interesting response, is that you said, I can't see anything other than total disaster. We've had a lot of ex-politicians releasing books. That does feel like the next title of a book for a Tory Prime Minister leaving office. I can't see anything other than total disaster. Rishi Sunak writes from the pit of despair, like the very first page. So I woke up on the morning after the local elections in May. I mean, it's interesting because that was the question I was going to ask you. Like, what is the threshold for a leadership debate? I mean, I guess the question with Morden and Badenoch, you know, both effective, good performers in their own right, is why would you want it? I mean, like, just to go there. I suppose you could say with you the hope of rebuilding afterwards, I guess.
No, you want it because it's your one chance to be Prime Minister, no matter how much. It might only be for 4 or 5 months, but at least you're on the list of Prime Ministers. So I've never really bought that argument. I mean, it may be that Kemi Badenoch thinks, well, I've got young family, I'd quite like to be leader after the election, so maybe she wouldn't stand. But you read all of the pieces in the papers, and it is pointing towards, if Rishi Sunak did quit, that Penny Morden might be sort of the short-term choice. I mean, she's got a lot of detractors on the right of the party, but they may just see, well, look, we need to keep as many seats as possible at the election, so we'll stomach her until after the election.
Do you think in that case that all the thing of like kind of getting a prime minister in, they just might rattle it through a bit quicker, like so none of the pomp and ceremony, you know, like they normally have the big car going to the palace, like they say, might have one of your Virgin bikes going there and the king just goes, yeah, you're the prime minister now, off you go, love, off you go. You know, just keep it really low key, like you're renewing vows rather than getting married.
I've just got this vision of Penny Morden putting on her, that cape that she wore, that dress that she wore at the coronation, on the back of a Virgin bike, carrying a sword. Going up the mall. Now, wouldn't that be brilliant?
At least there's an image there that they could hang an election campaign. They could go, look, things are tough out there, but look at Penny. Look at Penny in the cape. Remember the sword. That would be the slogan. Remember the sword.
And the thing is that any Labour MP that you talk to about this, they say she's the one that they fear. So wouldn't you then pick the candidate that you know your opponents fear?
Okay, so as I say, Basic Bloke is finished in terms of the UK and Ireland tour. If you want to see the show one last time, a bit like Phil Daniels rocking up for one last time with Blur to do Part Life, I am going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe for the last week, the last Wednesday to Sunday, which you would think I would know the dates for that. And of course, I do know the dates, and I'm absolutely not just buying time here. It's the 21st to the 25th of August in a really brilliant room at the Underbelly. And unfortunately, my dates do not coincide with Ian Dale being there. But tell us your dates, mate.
I'm up there the first 10 days or so. So from the 3rd to the 11th, doing two shows a day. Really looking forward to it. I got a varied list of guests, shall we say, which I was going to invite you on, but seeing as you're not there and you can't be asked, I won't.
Oh, mate, it's a great show and a really great audience. You're a great host and a great photographer. We spoke about this before,
some of
my favourite photos. So if there's any famous people who listen to my podcast, do it for the snaps. Do it for the snaps. But it really, I mean, it's part of a thing that's grown at the fringe. Is like the political discussion element of it is now like a genre in and of itself.
But in a sense, it always has been. I mean, you've always had the odd political interview. I got the idea from Matt Ford when I was there, 2015, where he was interviewing Tim Lawton, the Tory MP, and he had like a full house. And I was thinking, well, if he can do that, I can get some really big names. So I shamelessly stole his idea. And this is the fourth year I've done it. Last year, I got a bit pissed off because we always have like quite high profile guests. And there were all these articles in the Scottish papers about how disgraceful it was that politics was taking over the fringe and we were edging out theatre groups and comedians and taking up a venue. And I'm thinking, this is absolute bollocks. If people didn't want to come and see this sort of thing, they wouldn't. And yet they love seeing public figures up close in the raw. Well, not in the raw, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, well, is that a late night version, is it?
Yeah, but if you've got somebody with you for 70 minutes, inevitably, they're not just going to trot out the usual stuff they do in normal interviews. You get to know them more as a person, see if they've got a sense of humour. People can ask questions themselves. And I do it in a very sort of relaxed way. And I've got criticism for that. Well, you should have had a real go at Nicola Sturgeon. Well, sorry, it's the Edinburgh Fringe. It's not meant to be a hard-hitting political interview. All I want to do is to try and enable the audience to get to know what motivates people. And I sort of sprinkle it with some non-politicians as well, which, interestingly, sometimes they don't get the audiences that the politicians do, which I've always found a bit strange. So I've got Ben Shepherd and Chris Kamara this time. So that they should be quite good, I think.
Sheps and Cammy. I was on with Rosie Holt last time. It was great fun. I mean, like you say, it is a part of the fringe now. I did a panel chat thing. It was a thing hosted by Aisha, and Sturgeon was on. And it was really interesting getting to see her up close while her power base was still very much intact. Some of the most sycophantic reactions I've ever seen to a politician. Yeah. I've been around a few of them, but the way that people were bending the knee, oh, First Minister, please will you touch my child and heal them?
I remember last year when, because I didn't think she would do last year for obvious reasons. Mm. So I was very surprised when she said yes. And we upgraded the room to a bigger venue. And as we walked out onto the stage, I mean, it was like a Nuremberg rally for the SNP. And we sat down and I just looked at her and I said, difficult audience then.
Yeah. Oh my God. Absolute half folly for her every time at the fringe.
Yeah. And I mean, she's not doing this year. I mean, I did ask her, but I did say, look, I completely understand if this year isn't really going to work for you. And, but we've got Hamza and hopefully he'll still do it, even if he isn't First Minister. But in a Jeff Norcott exclusive, I can reveal my latest big name signing for the Edinburgh Fringe. But you've got to guess who it is.
Angela Rayner.
No, you've got 10 questions.
10 questions. Male or female?
Female.
Okay, a loaded question these days. Female, left wing or right wing?
Leftish.
Leftish. Rachel Reeves.
Well, she is a guest, but that's not the one I've just signed.
No, that's it. I win. 2 questions. Who is it? I'm intrigued now. I've actually got...
It's Miriam Margolyes.
Miriam, oh my God. Get the swear counter ready.
What possibly go wrong with me and her on the same stage out-smutting each other?
Oh my God, well, get tickets for that. It's going to be great at the Fringe. So that is, are all the tickets under For the Many or are they 2 separate shows?
Well, you can, they're all listed on the forthemany.live website. I mean, these are actually all talk ones. We're not doing For the Many in Edinburgh this year because Jackie's off to California in August. So there's, I think, 14 shows. I've still got 2 slots to fill. So any recommendations, do let me know. And we've got the likes of Alex Salmond, Ruth Davidson, Gina Miller, Liz Truss, can you believe?
So by that time, will it be only 9 3/4 years to save the West? Is she going to keep counting down? Okay, right. So it was just a question I wanted to ask you, because you and I think politically, in the public eye, you're one of the people that's closest to my politics. You've always been my Svengali of the centre-right. And I think we've had a similar emotional journey since 2010 with this Conservative Party. You know, we're people on the more socially liberal side that also voted Leave. So there's a lot of similarities. I was just thinking, you know, for a lot of the last 2 years, I've thought I'd find it very hard to vote Conservative at the next election, right? Because sometimes you vote against something, but you do have to have some reason to vote for something. And I would find that very hard. I was just wondering, you know, and presuming that these local elections are awful, is there a point where the idea of a super Labour majority becomes clearer, becomes more likely, that we do finally see that narrowing, that tightening of the polls as Middle England suddenly goes, hang on, a Labour government, let me just think this through. They're saying that they're not going to borrow and spend. How true does that sound of any Labour government? Does the idea of, you know, this idea that's been mooted recently of literally just destroying the Tories as an electoral force, could that in itself be something that eventually closes the gap?
It could be. I think the problem is it's very difficult to predict how low the Tories could go in terms of seat numbers. If they go incredibly low, it won't be because Labour has suddenly pulled away in the polls. I mean, they're quite far away ahead anyway. What I think it will be because of is the Reform UK vote. And if that gets anywhere near the sort of 15 to 18% mark, they won't win seats, but they will prevent the Tories from winning seats which they otherwise would have won. Now, on the other side, you've got the Greens, who, if Keir Starmer can't hang on to his left-wing vote, then they've got a place to go as well, and that could lose Labour a few marginal seats across the country. So I think those two things are far more important than whether the Tories are on 20, 22 or 25, or whether Labour are on 40, 42 or 45. It's actually looking at how the minor parties do. And also, look, you can't ignore the Liberal Democrats in this, because they could play an absolutely crucial role. Because again, if Reform take away votes sort of right-wing Tory votes in the south, southwest of England, the Liberal Democrats could then win quite a few more seats as well, which would reduce Labour's majority as well. So although we all think we know what the actual result is going to be, that it's going to be a Labour victory, the size of that victory, I mean, I could sit here now and justify a majority of 30 or 130 or possibly even 230. So it's not going to be one of those elections where people can say, well, I won't bother to vote because I know my vote won't really make that much difference. I think every vote will make a difference.
I mean, one thing that was interesting, I saw the polling for, and I think I mentioned this on the Patreon only, for the mayoral vote in West Midlands, right? So for a long time, Labour have been streets ahead, shall we say, with a shit pun. And then they took the revolutionary decision to put the name of the candidates on the poll, which I would have thought in a mayoral election is absolutely, it's about a single personality. You have to put the name of them. And then Andy Street, who is by most common consent quite a popular Tory, you know, as far as Tories go, he's got broad appeal, it then gets up to close to level pegging and if not ahead. And I just wonder if that might happen with the election at some point. Is obviously the national Tory brand is quite toxified, but like in the area I am, you know, there's an MP here, Jonathan Jangoli, has been an MP for a while. That simple thing of looking at the ballot paper is a very different thing to looking at the national polls. How do you feel about the Conservative Party as a Westminster force versus how do you feel about this guy or woman that's represented you for so many years? I'm just wondering, and this now sounds like fucking clutching it, the thinnest threads, if those are the kind of like the reality checks that might be, I'm not saying that it will evaporate the Labour lead, but that might be one of the few things that will reduce it.
Yeah, Jonathan Jangoli isn't standing again. I think you've got a new guy called Ben somebody in your constituency.
Oh, well, they fuck them, mate. If Jangoli's not standing, I'm not doing it, right? He's a good man. What have they done with Jangoli? Was he somewhere at 3 a.m? Was he texting? I'm with the bad men.
I don't think so. You see, I've got a problem. Where I live in Tunbridge Wells, we've got Greg Clark as the local MP, who's a very good MP and also a bit of a friend. So even though there is part of me that doesn't want to vote Conservative at this election, I'd feel an absolute shit if I didn't vote for him because he is good. But then I could vote in Norfolk because I've got a house there, get me. And I don't know the MP there and hasn't been particularly effective. So if I'm in an anti-Tory mood, I'll vote there. But it's like in the local elections. I don't know if you've got elections where you are, but we've got district council and Police and Crime Commissioner in Kent. And I've sort of like sat on the fence a bit because we've got three councillors that we can elect because they've changed it to, instead of having this ridiculous third, a third, a third, they're going all out elections this year. So I've voted for two Tory candidates who actually have been good councillors and then one for the Tunbridge Wells Independent Alliance. Just to spread my bets.
Fucking militant organisation from what I hear.
I think a lot more people are doing that. They're not being tribal with their votes in the way that they would have been 20 or 30 years ago.
I mean, there is that thing, you know, where a lot of people thought that old Red Wall voters were going to vote Conservative in 2017. It didn't quite happen because, as they call it, there's the pull of the ancestor, right? So you go to put your finger over the other lot and then your finger starts juddering and you go back to what you know. I am instinctively a Conservative, you know, very sort of towards the centre, but that is my political identity. Whether that means I support this government or this version of the Tory parties is another thing. And that's what I'm just wondering is that old tribal thing of just crossing the commons, although that fucking happened last week as well. So there's all sorts of thresholds being broken. I guess the thing that might make it just easier is that Keir Starmer, and this may be to give him some credit, he's just been on a 2-year campaign of essentially looking like a sort of centrist Tory. That's what he's done, and that's what might make it easier for people to cross the Rubicon.
But he's never going to persuade somebody like me to vote Labour, even though I have a high opinion of some of their people, and Rachel Reeves, Wes Streeting, Johnny Reynolds, one or two others. I have no fear of them as Labour cabinet ministers, but I fear what lies behind them, and the lefties are still there, and they're not going to go away. I could never vote Labour. I could never vote Liberal Democrat. So if I don't vote Tory, what do I do? Do I spoil my ballot paper? Do I vote Green just as a protest vote? Not because I agree with anything that they say, or very little of what they say. So it is quite a dilemma, I think. If you voted Tory all your life, to suddenly not do so. And I mean, I have in local elections over the last 10 years voted for, I think, 5 different parties. So it's not as if I've always voted Tory in every single election that's come along. But a general election is something a bit different, I think.
So just one quick last question on this subject. If you were to go down the spoiled ballot paper route, are you drawing cock and balls or just scribbling?
I haven't actually given that any thought, but I suppose I might.
Look, I'm just saying, people out there, start thinking. Okay, so Ian Dale, thank you as ever for your political insight and knowledge. So let's see how bad the Tory geddon is this week. Let's enjoy the headlines about Humza Yousaf quitting. Humbelievable or ho-hum. The Sun are going to have a fucking field day, let's be honest. But I really think I should direct everybody to your brilliant show live. I mean, if people enjoy the podcast, but even if they haven't come across it yet, it's All Talk at the Edinburgh Fringe. Remind us of the dates again.
3rd to the 11th of August at the EICC.
And the guests that Ian gets are going to be off the hook already. Miriam Margolyes, Jesus Christ, there's one. You know, do some magic mushrooms, have a drink, go down, enjoy the profanity. But Ian Dale, thanks for joining me in what I know will be an incredibly busy week for you. And hopefully see you soon, mate.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Really enjoyed it.
And we will be back, hopefully, with a breaking news episode once the local election results become clear. Have a good week.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.